impact the revolution has made. And then he met the imam, you know, together with other people that went to go to meet the imam. And then he told me that it is from that time when he heard about the revolution, even before he saw the imam, then he pledged to Allah that it is, if he comes to Iran, you know, any mazhab that the imam is following is the mazhab he's going to do. Because Allah Ta'ala has shown that his imam is accepted by him, and he's a good servant of Allah. That is why Allah has given him victory. But what happened is that after coming back, when the Sheikh came back to Nigeria, he went to, for instance, many universities, showing them the pictures of what happened in Iran, explanation of what happened in the revolution, and slideshows of things that happened in the revolution.
The victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran gave Sheikh Ibrahim an incentive to step up his activities. After 1980, he openly held his classes, and the number of his students increased day by day. After a year, he was arrested and handed a 4-year prison term. In those years, Zinat, who had become one of the top members of the Students' Association in Zaria, would go and visit Sheikh Ibrahim in prison. After she visited the Sheikh several times, he proposed to her.
The marriage was in July 1984. Alhamdulillah, we are blessed with 9 children, 7 boys, 2 girls. And immediately after our marriage, about 5 months after our marriage, and that is, and 2 months, I was 2 months pregnant of our first son, Muhammad. The Sheikh was arrested. He was arrested and accused of, is because of Islamic activities. And they accused him of saying there is no authority except that of Allah. So he was taken and he was detained without trial for about 9 months. And they were not even, they did not allow me to see him except once. So our first child was born when he was in prison. That is Muhammad. He was only released 48 days after the birth of Muhammad.
During the days Zinat used to take care of small children with stress and anxiety, a few thousand kilometers away in Tehran, something was about to happen that left a deep impact on her and her husband's life.
When he read the wasiyah of the imam, then after coming out from the prison, that was in 1989, he decided that now he really wants to learn. He wants to know what is it these imams have brought. And in the imam's wasiyah, you know, in the wasiyah that the imam made, he said that he spoke about the 12 imams, and he said he is calling on people to try to learn, to find out what is the teaching that these imams have brought. And there are people who do not know anything about the, we are people who do not know anything about the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. So it is not good, you know, to bring everything all at once and then made people to just run away, you know. So he tried with hikmah, but these people who have been used, some of them, they are sincere brothers, but they, because of their naive thinking, they were used, you know, by those who infiltrated to start talking of Shia Sunnah. Before that time, we didn't know anything to do with that. For instance, I can say there is one thing that a lot of brothers at that time told me, and sisters, that there was a lecture that we organized the birthday of Sayyida Zahra alayhi salam. So when we organized it, then there were a lot of lectures and symposiums, so we invited the sheikh to come and give us a closing speech. So at the closing speech, there is something that he said, which made a lot of us to start thinking that. He said, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he came to this world and brought his message. And then after he left the world, people, we have some hadiths from different sahaba, even among his wives. You will hear a lot of hadiths in the Bukhari and Muslim. They are saying Aisha radiallahu anha, she said this among his wives. But how is it that we have not had anything about reported from the Ahlul Bayt? Nothing reported from Sayyida Zahra, nothing reported from Imam Hassan, nothing reported from Imam Hussein. Why? Is it because he was teaching people outside and he forget his own family? Is it possible for them not to know? This, you know, he told us, he said, we should think. Why? Why is it that nothing is reported by them? When you look, you will not see any of their hadiths. Why is it that they do not know anything? He told us that some people say they are young children then. But people like Ibn Abbas, Abdullah Ibn Abbas, Ibn Umar, and all, they are all children too. They are age mates. Why is it that they know? But the children, the daughter of the Prophet does not know, or Imam Hassan. He said we should find out what happened. So that triggered a lot of people to start thinking that, it's true. Why is it that everybody will report from the Prophet, but his family does not report from them? So then you try to check for yourself. And this made a lot of people to start thinking that, there must be something that they do not want from these people. That is why they refuse to report from them. So, with the help of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the understanding about Ahlul Bayt started growing and growing. More and more. You know, actually what we can attribute this is just the making of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Even though Allah has used the sheikh for the spread of this school of thought there, a place like Nigeria where there was nothing, nobody knows anything to do with Shia. Only after the Islamic Revolution we started hearing there is one Shia, some people call Shia, and they do not even believe in the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. And these lies they are telling about Shia, it made people, when they find out these lies, that it's not true. In fact, they even believe more in the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, and they love the Prophet and his family more than other Muslims. Then they say, so it is lie. Then they start, this made them to start finding out, to know more and more about the school of thought. And it is very important for people to know that the revolution of Imam contributes a lot in spreading this school of thought.
About 200 years ago, a man named Sheikh Osman bin Fodio lived in Nigeria. He introduced the idea of establishing an Islamic government in his region and made efforts to materialize it. Sheikh Fodio's independence-seeking ideas were the most important impediment for the Western colonizers. So, the British colonizers decided that the best way to change the situation was to deviate people's ideas. The deviations still exist and have been materialized in phenomena like Boko Haram. Even though Zaria is a short distance away from Boko Haram's center of activities, Sheikh Ibrahim spread his thoughts to win the hearts and minds of the people in his homeland, not at gunpoint, but through reasoning and rationality. Sheikh Ibrahim would patiently listen to people and talk to them for hours. He believes that the only effective weapon is talking to the people, and once said, if people become aware, they will rise up and no power can stop them. He held the religious ceremonies with people because he believed that he should win people's hearts not their bodies. This is in stark contrast with Wahhabism, which resorts to intimidation.
Those who are against the mazhab of Ahlul Bayt are people who are having Wahhabist idea. They are the ones who are against. In Nigeria, they call them Izala. They are the ones who always propagate against, because their mentors are in Saudi Arabia, so they have that, something against the Ahlul Bayt, whatever I said. But most of them, they are not educated. So our greatest challenge is them, because they view the movement as a threat to them, to their own very existence. For instance, America, long before America said that that they will come here, that because now they have problem with the oil of Iran, that they don't have power over the oil. The Iran is independent, and they cannot come and take oil that like they used to do during the time of Shah. And now the Middle East is always have, there is always problem going on, and they are afraid what is going to happen, especially after the so-called Arab Spring. They started saying that their main resort now is Nigerian oil, because Nigeria has very sweet crude, and they said that it has one of the best crude oil in the world. So now they say that, but they are only, this is a security report. They say their only threat is one, they call him Mr. Ibrahim Zakzaki. That is their only threat now, you know? So the greatest challenge we are facing and the greatest danger we are facing is from America and Israel.
Shia Muslims in Zaria have been gathering on various occasions and have held religious or political ceremonies in a completely peaceful way for years. After the Arba'in gathering in Iraq, Zaria's million-man congregation is the second largest religious gathering. Over 7 million Shia Muslims take part in the event. The Quds Day ceremony is one of the main gatherings of Shias in Nigeria. People rally on the streets and peacefully chant anti-US and anti-Israeli slogans, but the West can't stand such gatherings. So, in the Quds Day rallies in Zaria in 2014, something happened that left a bitter taste in the mouth of Sheikh Ibrahim, Zinat, and their Muslim brothers and sisters. On Quds Day, Sheikh Ibrahim's three sons, Ahmad, Hamid, and Mahmoud, were on the front line of the rallies. They got martyred after the troops opened fire on them. Ahmad was 23 years old and was in charge of an institute named Abul Fazl al-Abbas. Hamid was a teacher in his brother's institute, and Mahmoud, who was 19, was the institute's website administrator. In the evening of the same day, Sheikh Ibrahim buried his sons and chose to remain silent over the incident. His silence dragged on for another year, but it seems the future had something else in store for him and his wife.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. At the core of the theory of a possible criminal case against former President Donald J. Trump is the argument that he knew he had lost the election and sought to overturn it anyway. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Panel Suggests Trump Knew He'd Lost the Election, Eyeing Criminal Case. Shortly after the 2020 presidential election, as ballots were still being counted, the top data expert in President Donald J. Trump's re-election campaign told him bluntly that he was going to lose. In the weeks that followed, as Donald Trump continued to insist that he had won, a senior Justice Department official told him repeatedly that his claims of widespread voting fraud were meritless, ultimately warning him that they would hurt the country. Those concerns were echoed by the top White House lawyer, who told the president that he would be entering into a murder-suicide pact if he continued to pursue extreme plans to try to invalidate the results of the 2020 presidential election. Yet, Mr. Trump time and again discounted the facts, the data, and many of his own advisers, as he continued to promote the lie of a stolen election. According to hundreds of pages of exhibits, interview transcripts and email correspondence assembled by the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack for a legal filing released late on Wednesday, 9th of March. In laying out the account, the panel revealed the basis of what its investigators believe could be a criminal case against Donald Trump. At its core is the argument that, in repeatedly rejecting the truth that he had lost the 2020 election, including the assertions of his own campaign aides, White House lawyers, two successive attorneys general, and federal investigators, Donald Trump was not just being stubborn or ignorant about his defeat, he was knowingly perpetrating a fraud on the United States. It is a bold claim that could be difficult to back up in a court of law, but in making it, the House Committee has compiled an elaborate narrative of Mr. Trump's extraordinary efforts to cling on to power. In it, Donald Trump emerges as a man unable or unwilling to listen to his own advisers, even as they explain to him that he has lost the election, and his multiple and varied claims to the contrary are not grounded in fact. At one point, Donald Trump did not seem to care whether there was any evidence to support his claims of election fraud and questioned why he should not push for even more extreme steps, such as replacing the acting attorney general to challenge his loss. The president said something to the effect of, "What do I have to lose? If I do this, what do I have to lose?" Richard Donahue, a former top Justice Department official, told the committee in an interview. And I said, "Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. Is this really how you want your administration to end? You're going to hurt the country. Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, also tried to get Donald Trump to stop pursuing baseless claims of election fraud. He pushed back against a plan from a rogue Justice Department lawyer, Jeffrey Clark, who wanted to distribute official letters to multiple state legislatures, falsely alerting them that the election may have been stolen and urging them to reconsider certified election results. That letter that this guy wants to send, that letter is a murder-suicide pact, Mr. Cipollone told Donald Trump, according to Mr. Donahue. It's going to damage everyone who touches it, and we should have nothing to do with that letter. I don't ever want to see that letter again. The account is part of a court filing in a civil case in California, in which the committee's lawyers, for the first time, laid out their theory of a potential criminal case against the former president. They said they had evidence demonstrating that Donald Trump, the lawyer John Eastman, and other allies could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the American people, and common law fraud. The committee's filing shows how some of Donald Trump's aides and advisers repeatedly and passionately tried to get him to back down from his various false claims and plans to try to stay in power. It started almost immediately after the polls closed in November of 2020, when members of Donald Trump's campaign data team began trying to break through to the president to impress upon him that he had been defeated. During a conversation in the Oval Office, Donald Trump's lead campaign data guru delivered to the president in pretty blunt terms that he was going to lose, Jason Miller, another top campaign aide, told the House panel. The president said he disagreed with the data expert's analysis, Mr. Miller said, because he thought he could win in courts of law. Jason Miller also told the committee that he agreed with Attorney General William Barr's analysis that there had not been widespread fraud in the election, and said that to the president on multiple occasions, the panel wrote in its court filing. In the chaotic post-election period, Donald Trump's legal team set up a hotline for fraud allegations and was flooded with unverified accounts from people across the country who claimed they had evidence of fraud. A Postal Service truck driver from Pennsylvania asserted, without evidence, that his 18-wheeler had been filled with phony ballots. Republican voters in Arizona complained that some of their ballots had not been counted because they used Sharpie pens that could not be read by voting machines. Mr. Trump appeared to be aware of many of these reports and would speak about them often with aides and officials, raising various theories about voting fraud even as they debunked them one by one. When you gave him a very direct answer on one of them, he wouldn't fight us on it, Mr. Donahue, the Justice Department official, told the House committee, but he would move on to another allegation. Mr. Donahue recalled, for instance, how he told Donald Trump that Justice Department investigators had looked into and ultimately discounted a claim that election officials in Atlanta, Georgia, had wheeled a suitcase full of phony ballots into their counting room on election day. Instead of accepting Mr. Donahue's account, Donald Trump abruptly switched subjects and asked about double voting and dead people voting, then moved on to a completely different claim about how, he said, Indians are getting paid to vote on Native American reservations. After Mr. Donahue sought to knock down those complaints as well, he told the committee, Donald Trump changed topics again and wondered aloud why his numerous legal challenges to the election had not worked. Jeffrey Rosen, another top Justice Department lawyer who became the acting Attorney General after William Barr left the agency, fielded this question, according to Mr. Donohue's account, telling the president that he was free to bring lawsuits but that the department could not be involved. Even though none of Donald Trump's persistent claims about election fraud turned out to be true, prosecutors will most likely have to grapple with the question of his state of mind at the time, specifically the issue of whether he believed the claims were true, said Alan Rosenstein, a former Justice Department official who teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. Alan Rosenstein said, to the extent that the prosecutors had to show intent, Trump's delusion makes that harder. A finder of fact could conclude that Donald Trump is so uniquely narcissistic and self-absorbed that he actually thought the election had been stolen. Throughout December, Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue repeatedly informed Donald Trump that both his specific and general claims of election fraud were false. At a White House meeting on 15th of December 2020, Donald Trump was told that people are telling you things that are not right, the committee said. Mr. Donohue personally informed Donald Trump during a 27th of December phone call in very clear terms that the Justice Department had done dozens of investigations, hundreds of interviews, had looked at Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, and concluded that the major allegations are not supported by evidence. The House panel also found evidence that some of the allies most deeply involved in Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his loss were aware that their endeavor lacked legal merit. Mr. Eastman, the conservative lawyer who advised Donald Trump that Vice President Mike Pence could throw out election votes from states he had lost, conceded during a conversation with Mr. Pence's top lawyer, Greg Jacob, that his arguments carried no legal weight and would fail before the Supreme Court. A rejection of electors by the vice president would be a relatively minor violation of federal law, Mr. Eastman acknowledged, agreeing with Mr. Jacobs's assessment that even the most conservative justices would reject it. If this case got to the Supreme Court, we'd lose 9-0, wouldn't we? Mr. Jacob recalled telling Mr. Eastman, according to his interview with the House committee. And he started out at 7-2, and I said, who are the two? And he said, well, I think maybe Clarence Thomas. And I said, really? Clarence Thomas? And so we went through a few Thomas opinions, and finally he acknowledged, yeah, all right, it would be 9-0. The committee recently received documents from the National Archives that showed some of Donald Trump's activities on 6th of January 2021. Among them were a morning meeting that included his eldest son's fiancée, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who has turned over 110 pages of documents to the House committee and was issued a subpoena on Thursday, a call with former Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia, and a call with Mike Pence, as he tried to persuade the vice president to go along with his plans. More than 150 police officers would be injured during the mob violence that would cost several people their lives. At 4:45 p.m., with the Capitol still under attack, on 6th of January 2021, Mr. Eastman wrote to Mr. Jacob, when this is over, we should have a good bottle of wine and a nice dinner someplace.
Aperture. Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we'll follow Javad Gharai, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good, long trip in the winter. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts: Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains, Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Floodwaters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadi Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Berries to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The valley, I mean the Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berri's Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berri's village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berri's. The villagers moved from Old Berri's to New Berri's around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berri's Wharf. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where Old Berri's used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in New Berri's. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Baris is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They are all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. And this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Baris is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Baris cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful the fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the kilkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful.
سیاد
One of the fishermen gave me this lobster and said I could have it, but I'm gonna let it go because it's carrying so many eggs. After my visit to Barry's Wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Oman. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Barry's is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs are where Barry's begins. Those are the shores of Barry's, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that have been here for thousands, or should I say millions of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff, and a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Barry's territory.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, farmers are calling for urgent government action to prevent soaring food prices and potential shortages in the UK. As the conflict in Ukraine threatens grain and oilseed harvests, energy costs, and the production of fertilizer. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sarah Butler. The piece is titled, UK Farmers Call for Urgent Action to Prevent Soaring Food Prices. In Britain, farmers are calling for urgent government action to prevent soaring food prices and potential shortages in the United Kingdom as the conflict in Ukraine threatens grain and oilseed harvests, energy costs, and the production of fertilizer. The National Farmers Union, NFU, has written to the government warning of multiple compounding factors that have profound implications and risks for our food security, including further pressure on labour costs as Ukrainian workers have made up about 60% of workers taking up seasonal worker visas to pick and pack produce since the UK left the European Union. It has called for a review of the immigration system to help bring in 10,000 more seasonal workers and for urgent action to prioritize gas for food production and make it easier to use organic fertilizers and manure as an alternative to those produced using fossil fuels. Minette Batters, the president of the National Farmers Union, the NFU, said the conflict in Ukraine had focused attention on the importance and fragility of food security, both here at home and abroad. There are some clear short and long-term actions that government can take to maintain confidence and stability across the UK's food-producing businesses, she said. Minette Batters added, "We have shared these with the government, and we want to stress that we stand ready to take these forward together in order to navigate the extreme volatility we see today and expect to grow in the coming months." While Britain does not import much wheat directly from Ukraine, the country plays a significant part in European food production, and the conflict in Ukraine has forced up food prices across the board. The country also accounts for about 45% of rapeseed, which is imported to the United Kingdom and used to make cooking oil, more than a fifth of maize imports, which are used for animal feed and biofuels, while 80% of sunflower oil comes from the Black Sea region and has been interrupted by the conflict in Ukraine, according to analysts at the UK's Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board. The National Farmers Union call for action comes as Yara, one of the world's largest fertilizer producers, said it was now running at only half its normal capacity after shutting down two plants in Italy and France this week because of the rising price of gas, a key input to the production process. Gas prices have risen amid the risk of a cutoff in supply from Russia, which produces about 40% of the gas used in Europe. Svein Tore Holsether, the chief executive of Yara, one of the world's largest fertilizer producers, warned that further closures could be on the cards if gas prices continue to rise. As well as potentially affecting the production of fertilizer by the autumn, it could also hit supplies of carbon dioxide, a byproduct of the production process which is used in animal slaughter and food packaging. "Things are changing day by day. We have a lot of uncertainty at the moment, and it is hard to predict going forward, but there is real risk that carbon dioxide will be impacted as a result of this." Meanwhile, pig farmers warned that the industry faced collapse as the soaring grain price only added to existing cost prices on feed and from labour shortages. "The situation is now beyond desperate, and there is no light at the end of the tunnel," said Rob Mutimer, chair of the National Pig Association in Britain. The group has written to retailers asking for an increase in payments to more than £2 per kilogram, more than 50%, or about 70 pence more than is currently being paid. Without the extra payment, the National Pig Association said more farmers would quit the industry, which has suffered months of difficulties. "We're staring down the barrel of a total collapse of the British pig industry, which is not only a tragedy for the producers themselves, but will leave UK consumers short of one of their favourite and most versatile meats," he said. The wheat price now stands in the region of £300 a tonne, compared with about £215 a tonne just a few days ago. Poultry and pork producers are likely to be first to be affected by the rising grain prices, as bakeries and other producers using flour generally pay for their supplies well in advance.